relationships are really hurt by this looking to each other for something only God can give. Now, complicating matters further is the curse upon Eve. Remember, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. There is an ache in Eve now that she tries to get Adam to fill. There is an emptiness given to her to drive her back to God, but she takes it to Adam instead. It makes a mess of many good relationships. You know all about this. No matter how much Adam pours into your aching soul, it's never enough. He cannot fill you. Maybe he's pulled away because he senses you're asking him to fill you. Every woman has to reckon with this. This ache she tries to get her man to fill. In order to learn how to love him, you must first stop insisting that he fill you. We say all this as a sort of prologue, because we can't talk about loving a man well, whoever he might be in your life, until you see that you cannot look to him for things he cannot give. You cannot love Adam while you are looking to him to validate you. It will usher in way too much fear. If he's the verdict on you as a woman, you won't be able to freely and truly offer him your beauty. You'll hold it back in fear, or you'll give yourself over to him in inappropriate ways, in a sort of sexual or emotional promiscuity, desperate for his attention. And you won't be able to confront him and stand up to him when he needs that from you as well. And so you've got to ask Jesus to show you what you've been doing with your question and how you've related to Adam. Only then can we talk about loving men.
How does a woman love a man? Let's start with sex. Not because it's all men think about, as many a cynical woman has said, but because it presents the relationship between femininity and masculinity in such a clear way. It is a beautiful and rich metaphor, a very passionate and heightened picture for a much broader reality. The question before us is, how does a woman best love a man? The answer is simple. Entice him, inspire him, allure him. Think of a woman on her wedding night. She dims the lights and puts on a silky something that accentuates the loveliness of her body, reveals the beauty of her naked form, yet also leaves something yet to be unveiled. She puts on perfume and lipstick and checks her hair. She allures her man. She hopes to arouse him and invite him to come to her and enter her. In an act of stunning vulnerability, she takes life's greatest risk, offering her unveiled beauty to him, opening herself up to him in every way. And as for her man, if he does not rise to the occasion, nothing will happen. There will be no consummation of love, no life conceived, unless the man is able to offer his strength to his woman. That is how we make love. Femininity is what arouses his masculinity. His strength is what makes a woman yearn to be beautiful. It's that simple, that beautiful, that mysterious, and incredibly profound.
You see, the beauty of a woman is what arouses the strength of a man. He wants to play the man when a woman acts like that. You can't hold him back. He wants to come through. And this desire is crucial. Don't you want him to want to come through for you? Not to be forced to, not because he ought to, but because he wants to come through. Well then, arouse his desire in any facet of life.
Can you imagine what it would be like if a young bride took the approach toward her new husband that so many women take in other matters? Imagine her getting on her day timer and asking, "When would you like to have sex this week?" The efficient woman. Or commenting to her new husband, "I suppose you'll want to have sex tonight. Well, let's get it over with early. I have a lot to do in the morning." The busy woman. Or the more direct challenge from the demanding woman. "That was a pretty poor performance last night. You want to try it again?" You get the idea. Your message to your man is either, "Sugar, you have what it takes," or, "I don't think you're much of a man. Want to prove me wrong?" The same is true for a woman. Your heart responds very differently to the pressure to be beautiful. You're going out in that? As opposed to the assurance that you are beautiful. Sweetheart, you look so lovely tonight. A woman wants to feel beautiful. The strength of a good man makes her feel so. A man wants to feel strong. The beauty of a good woman makes him feel so. This principle plays out far beyond sex and marriage. Knowing his story. Men may sometimes joke or moan that women are a mystery to them, and well, we often are. But the opposite holds true as well. I live in a household of four men, and they are often a mystery to me. I know many, many women who experience the same kind of befuddlement. It is immensely helpful to understand the man in your life by coming to know his story. What was life like growing up for him? How were the deep questions of his heart answered? Did he know he was loved? Was he encouraged as a boy and as a man? Was he told he has what it takes? What is he still living with and under? Pursue your man by inviting him to tell you his story, the story of his childhood, his teen years. Ask him about good memories and bad ones. Really listen. Growing in your understanding of where your man is coming from will help you to love him, have mercy for him, and the ability to encourage him to pursue his own healing and live differently.
The holy, scandalous women of the Bible. There are five women mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. Now, that might not strike you as a big deal until you understand that women are never mentioned in those genealogies. It's always men. The father of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. They read like baseball scorecards. When Matthew adds a few women to the cast, it is a major and notable exception. These women are so important to God that he has the writer break all cultural norms and even open himself to criticism and dismissal in order to make a point. Look here. These are really good women. Of course, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned. There's also the Bible study favorite Ruth and two others, Rahab and Tamar. What distinguishes these women? Different situations, different acts of obedience, yet the common theme is this: courage, cunning, and stunning vulnerability. Mary is an amazing young woman, maybe 15 or so. She accepts the mission God brings to her, even though it will cost her dearly. Really now, a young girl, known to be seeing an older man, turns up pregnant, claiming she's been impregnated by God? She is virtuous, but her choice will be seen by others as scandalous all her life. She makes herself vulnerable, staggeringly vulnerable. She could be stoned for this. Certainly, she will be abandoned and ostracized. She does it in order to follow God. Tamar's story is difficult and beautiful, one we don't have time for here, but one worth wrestling with. You can find it in Genesis chapter 38. She uses cunning in the face of men who are failing her badly in order to expose their sin and invite, not demand, invite them to come through. Rahab is another scandalous story. She's the woman who committed treason in order to walk with God and save her family. She hid the spies of Israel when they came to her city, Jericho, on a pre-invasion reconnaissance mission in open defiance of her government. We haven't heard any Bible studies on that one either. When treason becomes essential for a woman. And then there is Ruth. This is how I explained her story in Wild at Heart. Ruth, as you'll remember, is the daughter-in-law of a Jewish woman named Naomi. Both women have lost their husbands and are in a pretty bad way. They have no man looking out for them, their financial status is below the poverty line, and they are vulnerable in many other ways as well. Things begin to look up when Ruth catches the eye of a wealthy single man named Boaz. Now, Boaz is a good man. This we know. He offers her some protection and some food. But Boaz is not giving Ruth what she really needs, a ring. So, what does Ruth do? She inspires him. She allures him. She arouses him to be a man. Here's the scene. The men have been working dawn till dusk to bring in the barley harvest. They've just finished, and now it's party time. Ruth takes a bubble bath and puts on a knockout dress. Then she waits for the right moment. That moment happens to be late in the evening after Boaz has finished celebrating. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. From chapter 3, verse 7. Note that gentle phrase, good spirits. The King James describes it as had a merry heart as a result of the wine at the party. There is no possible reading of this passage that is safe or nice. Yes, there are folks that'll try and tell you that it's perfectly common for a beautiful single woman in that culture to approach a single man who's had too much to drink in the middle of the night with no one else around the far side of the grain pile and tuck herself under the covers. They're the same folks who'll tell you that the Song of Solomon is nothing more than a theological metaphor referring to Christ and his bride. Ask them what they do with passages like, your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. That's a Bible study, right? No. I do not think Ruth and Boaz had sex that night. I do not think anything inappropriate happened at all. But this is no fellowship potluck either. I'm telling you, the church has really crippled women when it tells them that their beauty is vain and that they are at their feminine best when they are, quote, serving others. A woman is at her best when she is being a woman. Boaz needs a little help getting going, and Ruth has some options. She can badger him. All you do is work, work, work. Why won't you stand up and be a man? She can whine about it. Boaz, please hurry up and marry me. She can emasculate him. I thought you were a real man. I guess I was wrong. Or she can use all she is as a woman to get him to use all he's got as a man. She can arouse, inspire, energize, allure him. Ask your man what he'd prefer. Now, am I suggesting that a single woman spend the night at her boyfriend's apartment in order to arouse him to marry her? No. Am I saying that a married woman ought to offer herself sexually to her husband even though he's been abusive to her? No. No more than the story of Peter walking on the water tells us all to get a boat, go out on a lake, and give it a try. The principle of the story is what matters here. Ruth takes a risk every woman knows, when she makes herself vulnerable and alluring to Boaz. She arouses him to play the man. She awakens his desire to be the hero. That's the point.
Emasculating women. Women pretty much fall into one of three categories: dominating women, desolate women, or arousing women. The first two are what happens to Eve as a result of the fall. The third is a woman whose femininity is being restored by God and who offers it to others. We mentioned Annie in The Horse Whisperer as an example of a dominating, emasculating woman. She needs nothing from her man. She has life under control. She wears the pants in the family. Her message is clear. You are weak and untrustworthy. I am strong. Let me lead and things will go fine. The effect on a man is not good. When a woman becomes controlling and not in the least vulnerable, her seductiveness is shut down. The message is, back off. I'll handle this. Any wonder that he backs off? So many women fear the wildness God put in their man. They are drawn to his strength, but then they set about taming him once they've caught him. I don't want you riding a motorcycle anymore. I don't want you hanging around your friends so much. Why do you need to go off on all those adventures? Women who make their husbands pee sitting down. But there are other types of emasculating women. In the movie Enchanted April, we meet four women. two who are desolate, and two who are emasculating. Caroline is a woman who is beautiful with the kind of beauty most women envy, but hers is a severe beauty. She uses it like a weapon to get what she wants, leaving a trail of broken hearts in her wake. There is nothing soft about her. Softness is key to a woman, not weakness. Softness, tenderness. Mrs. Fisher, a wealthy widow, is the other emasculating character. She orders everyone around, runs her world like a dictator. She shows no emotion unless it is disgust in someone's apparent weakness. There is nothing alluring about her at all. Emasculating women send a clear message. I don't need you. I refuse to be vulnerable and inviting. You have nothing to offer me.
Desolate women. The third character in Enchanted April is Lottie. She's not harsh, just shut down from years of living with a selfish, domineering pig of a man. She looks like a whipped puppy, rushing to please him in any way, not out of love, but out of fear and some weird idea of submission. She is depressed. Rose is Lottie's friend. They meet at church. She is the religious woman, the typical church lady. She's actually quite beautiful, but she dresses in such a way as to hide it. Bag-shaped dresses, hair in a bun. Her heart is also shut down. She hides behind her prayers and her good works of service. She is weary and tired. Desolate women don't seem at first pass to be all that emasculating. They don't attack or dominate, but neither do they allure. Their message is simply, there's nothing here for you. The lights are off. They have dimmed their radiance. No one is home. A man in her presence feels uninvited, unwanted. It's a form of rejection, emasculation to be sure, but it's harder to point out because it's so subtle. Desolate women can also be those whose ache is what defines them, women who will do whatever it takes to get a man. The woman at the well in John 4 would be an example. She moves from lover to lover, trying to fill the void within her. She's available, but in a clingy, desperate way, groveling, as one friend described it, manipulating, begging for attention. Like the character Catherine Zeta-Jones plays in The Terminal. Their message to men is, I need you too much. Please tell me who I am. Fill me. Men use women like this, but they do not love them. They do not feel challenged to be a hero. Desolate women do not call the men in their lives to be heroes.
Arousing women. If you would be loved, be lovable. Ovid.
The beautiful story in Enchanted April is how each of the women actually becomes a woman indeed. Caroline softens, becomes tender and vulnerable. She no longer resents her beauty, but offers it gently, almost shyly, which for her is repentance. Lottie and Rose gain a sense of self. They become substantive, able to offer their men a real mate, not a doormat. They too become alluring. Being less shy is repentance for them, no longer hiding, but coming forward in a gentle way. The effect on the men in their lives is astounding. What severity and domineering and hiding and whining could not do, beauty does. Their men come forth as good men, repentant men, heroes. An arousing woman is one who calls forth the best in a man by offering who she is as a woman. Someone who offers her beauty, her true heart, like we described in the last chapter. Such a stark contrast is set out in the movie A Walk in the Clouds. There are two women in Paul Sutton's life, played by Keanu Reeves. His wife is not an arousing woman. She pressures him. You are not the man I want you to be. She is manipulating and demanding. Eventually, she has an affair. Now, the Hispanic woman he meets on the bus, however, is alluring. A strong and self-confident woman, she is also soft and inviting. You are an amazing man. Who do you think wins his heart? However it is expressed in the uniqueness of your own femininity, arousing Adam comes down to this. Need him and believe in him. That's what a man needs to hear from his woman more than anything else. I need you. I need your strength. I believe in you. You have what it takes.
Loving fallen men. Granted, not every man is on the road to redemption. There are men out there who are not safe and good men. Some of you are married to men like this. All of you will encounter them. How do you love them? With great wisdom and cunning. The last three chapters in Dan Allender's book, Bold Love, are loving an evil person, loving a fool, loving a normal sinner. You might find them helpful. Jesus said, "Do not throw your pearls to pigs," in Matthew 7, verse 6. By this, we don't think he was calling some people pigs. He was saying, look, be careful that you do not give something precious to someone who at best cannot recognize its beauty, or at worst will trample on it. Consider your feminine heart and beauty, your treasure, your pearls. A woman can test and see if a man is willing to move in a good direction by offering a taste of what is available with her if he does. She does not give everything in a moment. Like God does, she allures and waits to see what he will do. We'll try and offer a few examples. Janice is married to a dull man, a man whose heart was so far buried she wondered if he was even there. Her anger and disappointment with him only drove him further underground. He wasn't a violent man. To her knowledge, he had no addictions. He was just absent. Checked out as a human being. He was functioning, but not passionate. A roommate, but not a lover, let alone a hero. She decided to play Ruth. One night, when he came home, he found the children were off for a night at Grandma's. The table was set with a beautiful meal. Candles were lit. This is so much like the story of Esther, too. Janice was wearing a beautiful blouse, discreetly unbuttoned several buttons down. As the evening progressed, she unveiled the laced underwear she was wearing underneath. She invited him to make love. Now, what is important is what followed. The next night he came home, hoping for a similar feast. When he moved towards her, she asked him softly why. He was a bit stunned by the question. Why do you want me? Is it only for my body, or are you pursuing my heart? It was a brilliant trap, well set. He stumbled for an answer, but his intentions were exposed. I long to give myself to you, she said, but you need to give yourself to me. I want your heart in this marriage, not just your laundry. She awakened desire in him, but did not give herself to him that second night. She waited for him to move closer emotionally. It began an awkward but hopeful journey towards deeper intimacy.
Betsy was married to a verbally abusive man. An elder in the church, he looked great outside the home, but behind closed doors, he was just plain mean. She chose to keep her heart alive, to try and invite him to see what he was doing to her and how they might share something far better. She asked if he might see a counselor, which he did, until things got too close to home for him, and then he bailed. She finally moved out, not seeking divorce, but as an invitation for him to feel the weight of the consequences of his life and his lack of repentance. She fasted and prayed. He did not choose to change, but laid the blame on her. He villainized her to their children, to his church. She held her ground. We're sad to say that he filed for divorce. She gave him many tastes of what life could be like together if he would repent of his meanness. He chose not to. Like the story of Jesus with the rich young ruler, she let him walk away.
How generous and lavish God is with his beauty towards us. He sends the sun each day. He sends music and laughter and so many notes to our hearts. But he also says, "You shall find me when you seek me with all your heart." Jeremiah 29, verse 13. That is a good way for a woman to live as well, not defiant, not hiding, but alluring and watching to see if he wants to come closer. Now we realize that many women need healing in their sexuality if they are going to enjoy sex with their spouse and live in wholeness as a sexual being. We've included a prayer for sexual healing in the appendix of this book. You will find it immensely helpful.
Single women. It might be encouraging to point out that Mary, Rahab, Ruth, and Tamar were all single women when the story of their greatness was told. True, Mary was engaged, but she had reason to believe it wouldn't last long when she gave her yes to God. They are such powerful reminders that this greatness, this beauty, can be lived out as a single woman. They also stand in stark contrast to some of the messages of, quote, purity given to single women today, as one young woman wrote to us.
I'm afraid that I and numerous other women have interpreted womanly purity as completely ignore the man you are interested in until he proposes to you.
And why, then, would he propose to you?
Of course a woman should be alluring to the man she is attracted to. A smile, a tenderness, an interest in him and his life are natural and welcome. To look your best, awaken him to your presence. Yes, you can offer beauty to him in gently increasing amounts as he pursues and comes closer. And yes, there are parts of you that should be held as mysteries until he fully commits, and you offer yourself to him on your wedding night. Don't offer everything, but don't offer nothing. How much and when? That is more than we can say in a chapter. Walk with God. Be a wise and discerning woman. Be aware of the issues that could cause you to hold back or give too much. Be aware of the issues in him that could cause him to look to you for his validation or become paralyzed. Invite, arouse, and maintain your personal integrity.
There is an emotional promiscuity we've noticed among many good young men and women. The young man understands something of the journey of the heart. He wants to talk, to share the journey. The woman is so grateful to be pursued, she opens up. They share the intimacies of their lives, their wounds, their walks with God. But he never commits. He enjoys her, then leaves. And she wonders, what did I do wrong? She failed to see his passivity. He really did not ever commit or offer assurances that he would, like Willoughby to Marianne in Sense and Sensibility. Be careful, gals, that you do not offer too much of yourself to a man until you have good, solid evidence that he is a strong man willing to commit. Look at his track record with other women. Is there anything to be concerned about there? If so, bring it up. Also, does he have any close male friends, and what are they like as men? Can he hold down a job? Is he walking with God in a real and intimate way? Is he facing the wounds of his own life, and is he also demonstrating a desire to repent of Adam's passivity or his violence? Is he headed somewhere in his life? A lot of questions. But your heart is a treasure, and we want you to offer it only to a man who is worthy and ready to handle it well.
Good men that do not belong to you. The way femininity can awaken masculine strength, and the way a good man's strength allows a woman to be beautiful, these can be offered in all sorts of holy ways between men and women who are not married to one another. Far too long we have lived in a culture of fear in the church, fearing that any relationship between men and women will end in an affair. Sadly, we have forsaken so many opportunities to call one another forth with the grace of our genders. John wasn't able to be present for our recent women's retreat. On the second day, I had an encounter with an evil woman that left me shaken and under spiritual attack. I asked our colleague, a young man named Morgan, to pray for me. He did, fiercely. He rose up on my behalf and sent the enemy packing. His prayers and his kind words to me allowed my heart to rest again and carry on through the day. I made myself vulnerable to him. I needed him in a perfectly innocent way. He came through for me, offered his strength in a perfectly innocent way. My thanks to him was a way of saying, "You have what it takes." Should that not be an encouragement to him?
In the same way, There are women in our fellowship who have offered to me many words of encouragement, many tender kindnesses. They have spoken to me of how I have impacted their lives, touched their hearts, offered my strength on their behalf, and that has brought a great encouragement and inspiration to me, even at times when I felt I was failing Stacy as a man. But their encouragement and inspiration did not make me want to have an affair with them. It actually fueled my fire to go back and offer my strength to Stacy. It was a kind of affirmation that said, "You are a good man, a man of strength, and as a woman, I am grateful."
John has offered his strength and kind heart to many women in our community, listened to their lives, helped them find their way, fought fiercely for many of them. His strong, kind presence awakens their beauty. In some sense, it is God saying to them, "This is available, not here in John, but this kind of man is available." Doesn't that awaken your heart as a woman?
There are all sorts of opportunities in our lives for this. Truth be told, it will be unavoidable. As a man comes alive, the women in his world will experience and enjoy his strength, the power of his masculine presence. As a woman comes alive, the men in her world will experience and enjoy her beauty, the richness of her feminine presence. Yes, this exchange of strength and beauty will be a test of character. When something is awakened in us by another man or woman, we do have a choice in that moment. We choose to accept the awakening as an invitation to go find that with our man or woman, or to pray, if we're single, that this sort of man or woman will come to us from God's hand. We will have to face this kind of test as we relate to members of the opposite sex. The only other option is to veil ourselves, as the Muslims insist that their women do. A sad and unbiblical way to live.
Remember our answer to the question, how do I love a man? Entice him. The sexual connotation of entice may have some of you struggling still with all those situations in which sexual intimacy is not appropriate. We mean it as a principle, a picture of how femininity can arouse masculinity in many, many ways. Perhaps you have heard the old story attributed to Aesop about the argument between the north wind and the sun. It might help you get past your concern.
The north wind and the sun had an argument one day. They disputed which of them was the stronger. A traveler came along the road at that time, and the sun suggested a way to resolve the argument. Whoever was able to cause the traveler to remove his coat would be the stronger. The wind accepted the challenge, and the sun hid himself behind a cloud. The wind began to blow. Yet the harder he blew, the more the traveler clutched his coat about himself. The wind sent rain, even hail. The traveler clung even more desperately to his coat. Finally, in despair, the wind gave up. The sun came out and began to shine in all his glory upon the traveler. Quite soon, the man had removed his coat. "How did you do that?" asked the wind. "It was easy," said the sun. "I lit the day. Through gentleness, I got my way."
Chapter 10, Mothers, Daughters, Sisters.
We have our mother tongue, which is our native language. We have our mother earth, from which all growing things come, and mother nature, the unpredictable source of typhoons and tornadoes. The mother load is the source of riches, and a mother headache is one that sends you to bed. The mother of all storms is fierce, and the motherland is the home we left and long for. Mother is the source of life. Mother is powerful. Mother is strong. Mother can nurture, and mother can destroy. Depending on our experiences, the word mother can evoke images of a warm, welcoming woman, or turn our blood to ice.
Whether good or bad, whether redemptive or destructive, our relationships with our mothers affected us to the core of our beings, helping to shape us into the women we have become. As Dinah says in The Red Tent, if you want to understand any woman, you must first ask about her mother and then listen carefully. We are not all mothers, but we all had one, or longed for one. The relationship between a mother and daughter is a holy, tender, fierce thing, fraught with landmines and umbilical cords that stretch and sometimes strangle. The desire in a daughter to please her mother is matched only by her desire to be separate from her. Most mother-daughter relationships go through a stormy season during the girl's adolescence. Hormones rage, and the brunt of the raging often lands on the mom. Words are flung, accusations aimed at the heart. "You're not going to wear that, are you?" has been uttered by many a mother in horror as her daughter is getting ready to go out. "You don't even know what you're talking about," has been slung by many a daughter. The way a mother weathers this stormy season of her daughter's transition from girlhood to womanhood can affect their relationship for the rest of their lives.
Many a good woman makes the desperate mistake of believing that her daughter is a reflection of herself, an extension of herself, and therefore the verdict on her as a mother and as a woman. She is dumbfounded, disappointed, sometimes wounded deeply when her little girl makes choices wholly foreign to what she would have chosen. The result of entangling the verdict on yourself as a woman with your daughter's life is deep wounding and a further twisting of the relationship. The mother will try and set things right. The daughter will pull away even further to establish her own identity. Mothers rightly teach their daughters how to behave and what to believe. The decision to continue to hold on to what has been taught belongs to the daughter when she comes into her own. A mother hopes that her daughter's coming into her own is a passage to celebrate, but often it takes years for a mother and daughter to reconcile their differences, let alone enjoy them. Girls' hearts flourish in homes where they are seen and invited to become ever more themselves. Parents who enjoy their daughters are giving them and the world a great gift. Mothers in particular have the opportunity to offer encouragement to their daughters by inviting them into their feminine world and by treasuring their daughter's unique beauty.
I don't know what it's like to have a daughter. I miss that. As I wrote this, my husband and sons were outside blowing things up. They're taking M60s apart and combining all the gunpowder to make really big explosions. Tea parties don't happen here. No one lets me brush their hair. But although I don't have a daughter, I am one.
The long road home.
My relationship with my mother was strained. It was painful for both of us. Our communication was fraught with hidden meanings and misunderstandings. Remember the messages of the wounds I received? She was grieved to have learned she was having another child, and that child happened to be me. I felt I was a disappointment to her in what I believed, how I dressed, what I thought, and who I was. It wasn't until I was 41 years old that I realized I made her feel exactly the same way. You remember my story growing up, how my mother was overwhelmed by my coming along. I was too much for her, and so I did my best to hide my true self and be the easy daughter she needed me to be. I longed for her to want to know me, to want to play with me. I loved kissing her cheek goodnight and inhaling deeply the fragrance of her night cream, something I continued into adulthood. I mentioned earlier that I used to pretend to be sick because then I got her attention. She'd give me books and read to me and bring me meals in bed. A high fever meant her love was coming, along with 7-Up and vanilla ice cream. It is no fun, by the way, being sick with John. He brings me enormous vitamins and horrible-tasting, good-for-me green drinks. In elementary school, my sister ingeniously told my mother that her teacher required my mom to read to her every night to help her with her education, a story she made up, but one that brought the desired results of snuggling with my mom and having her undivided attention for a full 20 minutes. We do what we can. When my mother found out that I was smoking in the 5th grade, she sadly said that I wasn't her little girl anymore. I cried. And I got better at hiding. She didn't know my dreams, my struggles, my gifts, or the treacherous path my life was taking. Throughout junior high, high school, and college, I appeared to be a good student who made no waves. Beneath the surface, I was seeking affirmation and life in all the worldly, destructive ways available. I felt unloved, unwanted, and abandoned, worthless, really. The choices I made from that place brought death to my own soul and death to others as I slid ever more deeply into despair, both hating and hiding myself. When I came home blasted one night in high school, after having been sick all over myself, and left my soiled clothes in the tub, neither my mother nor my father said a word. Nor did they confront me later when I came home too drunk to get into the house without their help. Being arrested for drunk driving cost me driving privileges for 2 weeks, but that was the end of it. One night, I simply didn't come home at all. When I finally showed up in the morning, I was met by a hysterical mother who had, during my absence, smashed all the drug paraphernalia I openly kept in my room. In her frantic worry to find me, she had looked through my school notebook to find my friend's phone number. What she found instead was a list of all the drugs I had taken in the last month. It was a very long list. I loved my mom. I didn't want her to know about the drugs. I didn't want to hurt her. Yes, she failed me. All mothers fail their children to varying degrees. But she also loved me. That was what was most true. I was shamed by her discovery, but I did not repent. No, not yet. Instead, I tried to become even better at hiding. I was sexually promiscuous during my college years, searching for the elusive feeling of being wanted, of being thought beautiful. My mother was a strong Catholic and often wondered aloud about people who had done things I had done, seriously questioning if God could ever forgive them, wondering how they could live with themselves. I took in her condemning words as blows while silently hoping God could forgive me, that I could forgive me. By the grace and to the glory of God, I became a Christian my last year in college. Jesus quite literally saved me. But I wasn't a Catholic anymore, or at least I wasn't pretending to be Catholic anymore. I faked it through high school. I was now attending a non-denominational church. My mom was glad that I stopped doing drugs. We pretended she didn't know about any of the sexual sin. She was glad that I was praying again, but she was deeply grieved that I wasn't going to her church. When we would broach the subject of faith, both of our defenses rose like battlements. We couldn't see each other over them, let alone hear what the other was saying. Instead of being a shared joy, our doctrinal differences became a barbed wire fence we could not cross. So we talked about the weather for 15 years. I read a story recently about a young woman who had just given birth to her first child, and her own mother had come to help care for her. The baby had kept the new mother up most of the night with his little mysterious noises, so she was going to ask her mom how long it was before you stopped hearing all those sounds. Before she could ask, however, her own mother asked her, "Are you getting a cold, dear? I thought I heard you wheezing last night." Huh. No matter how old your children become, they are still your children, just as it is true that no matter how old you are when your parents die, you are still an orphan. I don't know exactly when a softening began to occur between my mother and me, but slowly we became more graceful with each other. I do know that it began after I had looked honestly at my childhood and grieved deeply the wounds my parents had dealt me, inflicted by action as well as inaction. I had looked squarely at my youth. I'd been angry. I'd been sorrowful. And after a season, I was able to forgive. I began to see my mother with new eyes. My mother and I began to enjoy, even celebrate, our shared faith in God and not debate the differences. From out of the blue one day, my mom apologized to me for missing me, ignoring my questions and turning a blind eye to my struggles while I was growing up. I began to understand that in those years she had been treading water with all she had just to stay afloat.
Our last year together.
Lily, in The Secret Life of Bees by Sue Monk Kidd, says, "In the photograph by my bed, my mother is perpetually smiling on me. I guess I have forgiven us both, although sometimes in the night my dreams will take me back to the sadness, and I have to wake up and forgive us again. Years later, as God addressed yet another layer of unhealed wounds in me, I was grieving that in my mother's presence I still felt not good enough. I still felt like a failure to her, a deep disappointment. Her words continued to pierce. It was then that God showed me that the way my mother made me feel was exactly the way I made her feel. A disappointment, an embarrassment, a failure. And in that moment, I knew with utter clarity that it was true. I felt her sorrow. I saw some of her irritating comments to me in a new light. She wanted me to like her, know her, and enjoy her just as much as I wanted her to feel that way about me. And I had withheld my acceptance from her. I realized for the first time how deeply I had wounded her. I was compelled by God to see her as soon as possible. I was able to make all the arrangements, get on a plane within days, and fly to see my mother so that I could apologize to her in person. We sat at her kitchen table, and I offered her, perhaps for the first time, my true heart. I told her that I knew I had made her feel not good enough. I knew that I had made her feel that she was a disappointment to me. I told her that I was deeply sorry, that it simply was not true. I loved who she was. I was proud of her. I was glad she was my mom. And I asked her to forgive me. She couldn't speak. She didn't have to. But I understood by her eyes, through her shy expression and her tender countenance, that she did forgive me. We embraced then with nothing in between. How can I relate to you the spacious place in our souls that act of repentance and forgiveness created for us? The walls, the barriers came down. We could offer and receive each other's love and acceptance and enjoyment for the first time in our lives. We spent the rest of that evening looking over old family albums. Nestled up next to my mother, I heard her say, "Look how precious you are," pointing at pictures of a very young me. "You were always so adorable." It was a tender time, a healing time, a time that was true and real and full of love. It was also the last time we had together before she was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. A short month after our relationship's restoration, Mom felt like she was dying. She told her doctor the same, and he ordered some tests. The test revealed that her kidneys were failing. The cancer was extremely advanced. She was right. She was dying. My mom and I had 4 more months together, where we loved each other unconditionally and fully. How I wanted to have years together in this new place, and yet how utterly grateful I am to have had the time at all. God restored much to us in those months. I'm weeping now as I remember. Those times, those memories are gold to me.
The cost.
It is one thing to suffer. It is something far worse to walk alongside one you love who is suffering intensely and be unable to do anything about it. Many of you have lived this. You know. When I was 6 years old, I nearly cut my finger off in a slamming door. When the doctor was shooting the painkiller directly into my wound, I looked up at my mother through my streaming tears and heard her say that it was hurting her far worse than it was hurting me. I didn't understand her then, but I do now. During her illness, while I was visiting to take care of her, she looked at me and tenderly said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry to be putting you through this." Here she is, suffering, dying, in pain, unable to eat or even swallow, and she is sorry for me. She is sorry to be the cause of suffering in my heart. She would gladly have borne it herself and spared me the sorrow, spared me the pain of bearing her pain, her loss. I have heard it said that having a child is like having your heart walk around outside of your body. How a mother aches to protect her child. And yet all the while, from infancy to adulthood, a good mother is training her child to move ever more away from her, to need her less and less. Mothers love and long for their children. Their hearts ache for them, over them. A woman bleeds when she gives birth, but that is only the beginning of the bleeding. A heart enlarged by all a mother endures with and through her child's life, all a mother prays and works and hopes for on her child's behalf, bleeds too. A mother's heart is a vast and glorious thing. My mother's heart was expansive, having been enlarged by suffering and years of clinging to Jesus while being misunderstood, dismissed, and judged by those she loved most, me included. It had cost her to love, had cost her to mother. It always does. But she would tell you that it's worth it, that there is no other way. The last time my mother was able to walk to the bathroom, I helped hold her from the front while her sister held her from behind. On the way back, Mom had to take several stops to rest, walking a few inches at a time. At her last resting stop, I looked down into her eyes and said, "Well, what a great opportunity to hug you." I hugged her, lingering with her frail frame in my arms, and then looked into her sky-blue eyes. In those eyes, I saw the depth of my mother's love for me. It was measureless, vast, unconditional, tender, deep, strong, joyful, and clear. You could dive into eyes like that, get lost in that kind of love, or be found. Finally, I understood. My mother loved me. She had loved me during those years I just hadn't seen it. There was grace in her eyes and a knowing that all was well, that all would be well, and that nothing was lost, not in our years of missing one another, and not in the years that I am left missing her now. Both my parents are gone now, off and away and fully alive in heaven. I tell you this story because I want you to know that redemption is possible. Healing is possible. Ask Jesus to bring it to you and yours. Then, if you can, go. Call your mother. Tell her you love her.
To mother. As large as the role is that our mothers play, the word mother is more powerful when used as a verb rather than as a noun. All women are not mothers, but all women are called to mother. To mother is to nurture, to train, to educate, to rear. As daughters of Eve, all women are uniquely gifted to help others in their lives become more of who they truly are, to encourage and nurture and mother them towards their true selves. In doing this, women partner with Christ in the vital mission of bringing forth life. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." This verse is not a promise about faith. It is not speaking of training a child to follow Christ or promising that if you do, the grown child will continue to follow him. Sorry. The proverb is about raising a child to know who he is and to guide him in becoming ever more himself, in the way he should go, not in the way you would like him to go in order to validate you as a mother and as a woman. It speaks of teaching a child to live from his heart, attuned to it, awake to it, aware of it, and when that child has grown, he will continue to live a life from the heart. It is about seeing who a person really is and calling them out to be that person. The impact on a life that has been seen and called out is dramatic and eternal. The nurturing of life is a high and holy calling, and as a woman, it is yours. Yes, it takes many shapes and has a myriad of faces. Yes, men are called to this as well. But uniquely and deeply, this calling makes up part of the very fiber of a woman's soul, the calling to mother. We're reminded of a courageous African-American woman who was thrilled to purchase her first home. After moving in, she came home from work one day to find drug dealers doing their business on her front steps. It seems her new home was smack dab in the center of their territory in L.A. She wouldn't stand for it. Head held high, finger wagging, she mothered them to higher aims. She mothered them out of their sin. She mothered them into becoming the young men they were meant to become. You can mother other people's children. In truth, our world needs you to. Our friend Lori's house was the center of activity while her girls were still in school. Their friends loved to hang out at Lori's house. She offered them life. She counseled.